This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today it's a real honor to have on Canada's sweetheart, Elizabeth Manley, who, of course, you'll all remember as giving the performance of her life at the 1988 Calgary Olympics, where she became a silver medalist in figure skating, followed by becoming the 1988 World Silver Medalist, as well as being a three-time Canadian national champion, amongst many, many other accolades. She was also inducted into the Canada Sports Hall of Fame, the Canadian Olympic Hall of Fame, and the Skate Canada Hall of Fame, as well as being named as a member of the Order of Canada in 1988, recognizing her excellent contribution to sport, advocacy, and Canadian society. Before we meet her, let me tell you a little bit more about her. I can't resist. After spending more than 20 years in the United States performing and coaching, Elizabeth Manley, one of Canada's most revered Canadian figure skaters and Olympic medalist, now lives in Collingwood, Ontario. A renowned mental health advocate, Liz is also a certified life executive coach with CTI International and holds a degree with CCPC International Coaching Federation as well. She is a certified Reiki healer and a meditation teacher. She focuses on inner well-being, emotional traumas and issues, as well as motivating and inspiring clients to move forward in life in a healthier and more positive way. And as she says, the best project that you can work on is yourself. Her clients range from professional athletes to high-end executives. And Elizabeth has also worked with expert ADHD coaching as an executive coach. She's also written two autobiographies, Thumbs Up, which I devoured every word, and As I Am, My Life After the Olympics. She has three of her own major television specials, including Dear Elizabeth, which won her a Gemini Award. Nowadays, we call that a Canadian Screen Award. But I remember the days where your husband was all the producer of those Geminis and Genie Awards very well. Liz was named Woman of the Year by Chatelaine magazine in 1988 and Athlete of the Year for Canada in 1988. She's a member of Olympic Hall of Fame. I've mentioned some of these, but I have to say it because it's fabulous stuff. The Olympic Hall of Fame, the Ottawa Sports Hall of Fame, Skate Canada Hall of Fame, Belleville Sports Hall of Fame, Ontario Sports Hall of Fame, and Canada Sports Hall of Fame. She now spends her time coaching, doing speaking engagements, and lots of charitable work, as well as producing. She has a rink that the city named after her in Gloucester, Ontario, the Elizabeth Manley International Training Center. She has a park named after her in Ottawa, Ontario, where she spent many years. As well, she runs competitive seminars throughout Canada and the United States. Today, she's involved in hockey camps and working with multiple teams from Ottawa, Toronto, and Collingwood, OHL and NHL clients. Liz is the producer and star of the charitable event, Elizabeth Manley and Friends for Teen Mental Health, something that she speaks about in 200 schools a year, talking and helping people. Not only did she compete as an amateur from 71 to 88, but she performed as a professional skater from 1988 to 2016. And everyone, that explains the almost 20 years that she lived in the U.S. It was easier during that period to live there, right? Than getting on a plane every day. That's what my daughter does, back and forth. It's not easy. Liz achieved over 50 national and international medals and competed at six world championships during her career. It just goes on and on. She's been a broadcaster at many Olympic Games. She's a philanthropist and national spokesperson for, and this is very important, the Canadian Mental Health Association. She's a speaker for CMHA throughout Canada, a spokesperson for the Council on Drug Abuse, World Vision Canada, Eating Disorders Group, Ovarian Cancer Canada. She's been a national spokesperson, Alzheimer's Association of Canada, ambassador for Alzheimer's Society of Ottawa, guest speaker for Alzheimer's Society of Toronto, and so much more. Elizabeth Manley, longest bio in the history. What an honor, truly, to have you here.
I need a nap after all that.
Welcome. Welcome to
Thank
Finding
you
Your Bliss.
Thank you for having me, Judy. It's such a pleasure.
You were born in my mother's hometown in Belleville, Ontario on August 7th, lovely place, 1965, and you moved to Trenton the following year. Your father had a career in the Army. You've always called yourself an Army brat. And when you were five, you moved to Winnipeg where you had your first skating lesson and then moved to Trenton the following year where you moved into that big yellow house that you loved. You started first grade at Prince Charles Public School, but very early on, skating became your whole life. It became your priority. But I want to go back a little for our listeners. I think you put on your first pair of skates when you were only 2.5 years old, and your beloved late mother played a game with you involving the chocolate candy Smarties. For any Americans listening, Smarties, kind of like M&M's, but better.
Exactly.
So that you would skate over to the chocolates. And isn't it true that you learned how to skate before you were three? You had your three brothers and your beloved mother, Joan, found a way to motivate you in a hockey family.
Yes.
And you'd go flying across the ice to get those Smarties. Do you actually have a memory of doing this?
I do, actually, because interestingly enough, I actually really wanted to go into skating because I was tormented by my brothers all the time, growing up with three older brothers. And my household was live, sleep, and the NHL. They were all going to make the National Hockey League. And so I was kind of dragged to the rink. And there was a lot of times at the rink where they couldn't find me or I was running around. I was like 2 years old. And in those days, you could let a two-year-old run around. You really didn't have to worry. But my real ambition didn't come from that chocolate. It was really that I wanted to be a better skater than my brothers because my parents were at home. They'd shoot pucks at me in a street hockey net and they would do all these things, torment me. And so my real goal was to, okay, if they're going to put me into these learn to skate sessions, that's my start to be better than my brothers. No thoughts whatsoever about Olympics or being this great figure skater, whatever. I just wanted to be better than them. And I was going to prove to them I could be a better skater.
I love that. I love that. You actually were skating every day by grade three. And I just want everyone just to note that when you think about your own children or grandchildren in grade three and what they're up to.
I know.
That's a huge commitment.
By the time I was, I'm just going to jump ahead a little bit. By the time I was 10, my coach literally took over my life. And I was skating 8.5 hours a day, going to school, going to the gym for an hour. I'd skate before school. I'd go to school. I'd skate after school because they worked out a system. Even at 10 years old, they worked out where I could do half my school, what we would call today online school. So I would do a correspondence school.
Wow.
And so I could skate all afternoon. Then I would go for my what we call off-ice training. And then I would go back to the rink. And so my mom, you know, would send me off at 5 a.m. and she'd pick me up at 10 at night. That was my schedule by the time I was 10. But, you know, grade 3 and 4, absolutely. I was on that ice every day, you know, right after school. But it wasn't until I really got this very serious coach, like really believed I had that talent. And I'll never forget that meeting. He said, I can make your daughter into a champion. I would love to take her on. And of course, my mom laughing. She said, really? And he said, yes, but I have rules, and the rules are I'm completely taking over your life. And I remember the time my mom busted out laughing with glee because she said, a babysitter, this is great.
Isn't that fat? Because she worked so hard.
Yes.
And your beloved late mom, you were extremely close to her. And we're going to talk about her throughout this.
Yeah.
But I just want to ask you, you also worshipped your father. You, again, were the only girl, one of four, three brothers. But they got divorced. And in those days, that was not common. And I can relate to this because my parents got divorced in 1963 when I was 3 years old. So I really understand. And you were a young kid to be going through this.
Right.
What was the impact, would you say, of your parents' divorce on your life?
I'll be really honest about this. When I was sat down and told about it, I really didn't think a whole lot of it because I was on this schedule. As I just said to you, I was gone 13 hours a day, literally. And my dad was, I was a pilot in the Air Force and he traveled all the time. For me, it was like, okay, mom and dad aren't going to live together, but I'm still going to see him. I mean, he's still traveling. I'm still busy. It'll just be like that. But what I didn't know at the time was he took a posting to Europe. So I think I was about 10 or 11. It was right at that time when this coach took me over that I got what I call the big D word from my parents. And like I said, when it first was told to me, I didn't think much of it. But then when he moved to Europe, I mean, Judy, we didn't have computers. We didn't have ways of communicating like we do today, right? So my relationship with my dad for many years after that was handwritten letters. So I lost that father-daughter connection at an age where fathers are pretty important in a young girl's life, right? Especially when you're just going to get into your teens and everything. I thought I managed, only to find out later it had a lot to do with some of the situations I had gone through. But for me, it was more difficult to see my mom struggle because suddenly now it's a one income, trying to keep me in an elite sport, trying to pay the bills, things like that. And my dad was just out of the picture. So that's where I think it affected me the most. And I never told my mom that. I saw what she was doing, but I was right at that bratty age, 11, 12. I was kind of at that bratty age. So, you know, I got to a point where I sometimes didn't understand why I couldn't have something like another girl had, or why I couldn't have this, or why as an adult now, and I look back at it and I go, wow, I just don't know how she did it. Because I'm a coach now, and I see what the parents are putting into their kids and the time and the hours and things like that. And my mom did it all on her own. Because at that point, my brothers had all gone off to play hockey. They were being billeted in other cities and wasn't much of a worry. My dad was financially taking care of them and everything. But for my mom, it was tough. It was very tough.
It was tough. And she was determined, and she didn't want you to see her suffer ever.
Absolutely.
I think there was one night where she was crying on the kitchen table, surrounded by bills everywhere. I remember reading it. I think that might have been the only glimpse that you ever had. And then she quickly brushed it off. And I wonder if that's where you get your hopeful, optimistic, sunny side up. And even, I should just tell the listeners, you have this lovely lemon yellow background in your background, on your wallpaper, your paint. And it's so lovely. And I think it's you. It's very, very, very much you. You were very close to your mother, as you've just said. Until the end, you were there with her. And she passed away around 2006, 2008. Yeah. And I was touched by the story of how when you finally went from being an amateur to a professional and working for the Ice Capades, and your agent was so struck by the fact that when you made your first $50,000, instead of depositing it into your own account, which many kids nowadays would be doing, you immediately gave it to your mom. It did make me cry, actually, when I read that, to thank her for all that she has done for you in supporting your career. Can you tell us just more about your mother and really the impact that she had on your whole life?
My mom was always one of these people that said, Elizabeth, the day you change is a day I'm pulling you out of this sport. Because we used to see a lot in the sport, kids that got everything, kids that didn't work hard and got the win, or, you know, kids that worked really hard didn't get the win. So my mom would always see changes in people, especially when they suddenly become successful. And my mom was the calm in my storm. Everything that happened to me when I went into pro skating and I was traveling around the world, doing TV shows, things like that, she always kept me normal. And like you say, going back to this check, so I got a signing bonus. It wasn't a huge contract with Ice Capades because my agent at the time, and he still kicks himself to this day, he didn't know what I would sell. Like, he took me on as a favor to my coach. He was just a one-man agent, him and his wife, and they only had a handful of really good skaters, like Dorothy Hamill. You know, they had big, big names. So he took me on as a favor. And the night that I won the medal, he completely freaked out because he had another girl in the event that he thought would catapult to the podium and didn't. So it was very stressful for him. Every company wanted me, Disney on Ice, Ice Capades, all these different companies wanted me. A different agency wanted to, you know, convince me to leave him when I won that night. So when I got that signing bonus, as a typical Hollywood agent, because he lived in Hollywood, I remember saying, I'd like to go to my mom's bank. And he said, why? We're going to go celebrate. And I said, no, it's really important I do this. So he had a limo for us. I signed my contract. I retired from amateur skating. And we went right to the bank. And they're all with me. We walk into the bank. And I said to the bank, manager who I knew at the time. His name was Claire Roth. I remember he's passed away many years ago, but I said, this is a check that I just received as a signing bonus for Ice Capades, and I want you to directly put it into my mother's account to help pay for bills.
Aww.
My agent's like, what are you doing? Like, but you need things. And I'm like, I need this. This is what I need.
Wow.
So I turned the whole check over to her. I had never made money. I didn't understand the concept of really making the money and earning the money and things like that. And throughout my touring days, my mom was so good because she started to go to that point where she was like, I need to teach you how to do all these things because the day when I'm gone, you need to be able to do this. So she really was everything that I wanted. You know, we always joked, she was the best skating mom in the world because she never knew if I was doing a double or triple. She never knew what I was doing out there.
Perfect.
Only time that I knew that she was disappointed or that she felt bad that I didn't skate well, the way she would do it, she'd go, honey, your dress looked gorgeous. You know, and that was when I knew I skated bad, when I got the dress look gorgeous.
The dress look gorgeous. You're beautiful.
You're beautiful no matter what. She was amazing.
What an incredible person she sounds like. I really felt like I knew her in the books. And it was interesting. She really took on a life. Like I really saw her and it was very evocative.
Yeah.
The way you wrote about her, which was lovely. So I can only imagine.
My best friend.
Her in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. What an incredible thing to be able to say that you've had that. And even at the end, you wrote in one of the books that she didn't have a lot of speech at the end. She was suffering from cancer. But your first husband, mm-hmm. Brent, said to you, that's okay. You said everything that needed to be said. Yeah. You said everything. She said everything. It was okay.
I really had a hard time with that because she literally was in a coma for quite a bit of the end of it. And I was in denial. She was always my trooper. She was always so strong. And it's interesting. I remember there was one night because I never left the hospital. I slept in a cot beside her and I was looking at her one night, Judy. And I thought to myself, everybody that's ever interviewed me has always said, where did you get the strength to get through the things you got through? That was the moment that it hit me. I got my strength from this lady, from this woman.
Wow.
She just was so strong, which probably didn't help me in the moment because I was in denial. She was in a coma, but I thought she was sleeping, right? And, you know, the doctors were trying to really hard to work with me and help me through it. But I kept thinking she was going to pull through it, you know, and we didn't say our goodbyes. We didn't. I mean, I talked to her, but I don't know if she was listening or whatever. But that really stuck with me for a long time that we didn't say I love you or we didn't say goodbye when it was time, because you see them in movies, right? You get to say your final goodbyes and things like that.
Yeah,
I feel like totally. I was robbed of that. But I do have to give credit to my ex-husband when he did say that comment. He said, everything has been said between you two for years.
Yes.
And you always...
Through action. You didn't need the words, right?
Exactly.
You had the action.
Exactly.
That's really what it comes down to in the end. Right?
It really was.
And I feel like, I don't know if people realize the trials and tribulations, and we're going to get to it because we're going to unpack everything, but that you've been through. And through it all, there is something sunny and hopeful. And even I think when you went through depression as a teen and all of this stuff that happened to you, there's just something in you. And I think that might be your mother, of course, but I think it's you as well.
But I think she ingrained that in me without even knowing it. And now that I'm 59 years old, sitting here talking to you, I wish that I could have that chance to say, my God, thank you. Because there's been so many more downs than ups in my career, in my life. And I've somehow been able to pull myself through, make decisions that are hard, make decisions that hurt people, make decisions that I just have to do for me to be able to even exist.
Totally.
And I believe all the bad things that have happened, and I think with the work that you do, you can understand this. I think we have to really trust our journey in life and the process in life and understand that those things happen for reasons. You may not believe it at the time. My mom stood next to me at that rink in Montreal. I'll never forget. I had no hair. I was, you know, 55 pounds. Mm. Had no diagnosis, didn't understand what I was going through. And she said to me, she goes, Elizabeth, I promise you everything in life happens for a reason. And I remember when she said that, I went, really, Mom, have you looked at me lately? You know, like, I couldn't believe that there could possibly be a reason that this breakdown happened in me. You know, and I can sit here today and say, absolutely, I wouldn't be the person I am today without those things that happened to me.
So, you know, in this interview, when you're saying, thank you, Mom, and I love you, Mom, you know, she's hearing it. And I know you've probably had many moments like this. And I really believe that, or I don't think I could do this work, right?
Yeah, I do too. Absolutely.
Mom, there you go. I also had the sense that your father meant a lot to you as well, and that you wanted his approval. He was always a fan, though. And when you became an Olympic medalist and then also won the 1988 World Silver Medal, I think you finally realized what he knew all along, which was that he'd always been proud of you.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that?
When I went through my breakdown as a teen and lost all my hair and had to quit skating and, you know, that whole thing happened to me. And then when I reached out for help and got the help, I started to realize that I was holding something against my dad. And I think it was seeing the pain of my mom, not wanting to be divorced, not wanting to struggle the way she did to keep me in a sport, things like that. And I think I always held a little something. Maybe it was anger. I'm not sure what, but
you're a Leo.
You're a Leo.
And Leos are very protective. August 7th, 1965, right?
I'm a strong Leo too. I'll tell you that. When my dad moved back and he got to experience me at the Olympics, I saw the excitement and the overwhelm in him that night. And I had both my parents there at the Olympic Games, and I started to make time for my dad. When I was on tour, you know, we were touring in Binghamton, New York. And I said, you know what, Dad, why don't you come up? I have a day off. We can golf. Let's do some things that we've never been able to do. Yeah. Because when he left, I was just a young kid, right? And now I'm in my 20s and I'm touring the world. And so I made a point of really keeping that connection. And I actually became very close to my stepmother. She's wonderful. She's still with us today. We still talk all the time. She comes and visits. It took me to grow up a little bit to understand that's how things happen, right? If my dad wasn't happy, then that's the way it is. But I was so protective of my mother, right? Yeah. That I couldn't see that at that time. I didn't have the clarity of that. So my relationship with my father definitely, as the years went on, became much closer. I remember I was the one that was actually with him the last night before he passed away. He had Alzheimer's. Wow. So we were all taking shifts. My brothers would come in. My stepmom took most of the time, but I had to tell her, you need to go home, have a shower, rest and everything. Yeah. And I do remember, because he passed away only a year after my mom.
Yeah, hard.
I remember the thoughts of, I still had those fears that I hadn't said enough to my mom. And I wanted to make sure this wasn't going to happen with my dad. So I talked to him all night. And I said, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry we didn't have that little girl dad relationship. And I said, but I'm so happy we're at a place we are. And he was, you know, nodding his head. He was looking at me and he didn't get to that point where he didn't recognize people. I'm so thankful for, but I came to peace with it. His passing was harder than I thought it was going to be on me, because we didn't have a lot of years together as a dad and daughter, right? But what I built with him in those last few years before his passing was very memorable. I'm at peace with him and our relationship and the things that happened in the past. So I'm grateful for that. Yeah.
That's amazing. I sense that you're, and I want to leave this for the end, but I sense that you're very much at peace with yourself.
Try.
That's sort of like the vibe that I'm getting, though, just your energy and where you're at living in Collingwood and all the maelstrom and the storm and the drang of your life seems to be calmer now.
It is. I've worked hard on it, Judy. I'm not going to lie. And first of all, meeting your friend, David, after so many years, David, you know, produced my, he was my crush.
Your crush.
He was so my crush.
When you were 20. Okay, so to tell the audience, we're talking about the very handsome and the very funny, hilarious actually, David Rosen, who has always been a famed television producer in this country. And I think I said this off the top, he produced the Gemini Awards and the Genie Awards, and they've never been as good as when he was producing them, I will say that. And you met him in your 20s and you've called him your crush. And then 30 years later, you had this fairy tale romance. But what happened in your 20s? How did he become your crush then?
Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Finding Your Bliss and Elizabeth Manley when we come back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, FM 96.7. And just before the break, I was asking you, Elizabeth, how David Rosen became your crush.
So he produced my TV special after the Olympics, The Trial of Red Riding Hood, which we did with CBC. And I had such a crush on him. But I got over that pretty quick when he put his newborn baby into my arms.
That'll kill that pretty quickly, right?
That'll kill that vibe right away, right? And ironically, that baby now is my 35-year-old stepson, and we spend lots of time together.
Wow.
But I remember when it took a month to shoot the special, David is a true professional, taking care of, you know, the star of the show, so-called, making sure I had everything was running smooth. And for a whole month, we literally were in each other's hair all day, every day. And then when I ended up moving to the States, because we were now running into visas being, you know, set up every year, and my agent finally said, we got to get you a green card because you're always working over here. And when I got my green card, I moved to the States. And I kind of lost touch with a lot of people because it's a whole different world over there, especially now, but we won't get into that. But it's like, I all of a sudden just lost touch. And God bless David. He was constantly trying to stay in touch. And then I found out he would call my mom once a month, driving home from when he was working at Skydome, just to see how I was doing, how she was doing, because my mom was on the set quite a bit during the show. And I found this out much later. Oh, yeah. And my mom always called him DR. And she said, oh, DR called. And I know it was like 22, 23 years later, I moved back to Canada because of my mom and dad's illness. I was getting messages because then Facebook was alive. And I would get these messages from David saying, just want to say hi. I'm so sorry about your mom, all this. But, you know, Judy, when you lose the biggest part of your heart, you're not ready to talk to people. It wasn't just David. It was everybody was reaching out to me. And I just wasn't in a space. I was so depressed. I was rock bottom again. I was just, I didn't know how I was going to move on. And then wouldn't you believe it, about, I think it was 2 years after my mom died. It was her birthday. I was laying on my couch and I sat up and I went, I have to call David Rosen. So I reached out to him because he had always left his cell number on Messenger. And he almost fell off the couch. He says, I don't believe you. How do I know this is some fan club?
Really, you?
But David had made me a mug on the set, and it was a picture of me as Red Riding Hood. And through the entire TV show, he called me Little Red. Aww. And had Little Red. I had kept this mug for almost 25 years. So I said, I have something. Think better. I got the mug, and he couldn't believe I still had the mug after all these years. then my whole life fell apart. And I kept in touch with him. I was coming into Toronto for business. We met up for coffee. And I tell you, it was like I had just seen him yesterday. That was what the connection was. We hadn't seen each other in, you know, 25 years almost. Yeah. I was going through some rough times with my life. And then he started to go through rough times. And for years, we just regained this friendship and we helped each other emotionally through some difficult times, both in his life and in my life. Now, the next thing I know, I'm married to him. I'm living here. It's like, but.
And you're at the Scarborough Golf Course, according to Nancy Crosley, yeah, another mutual friend of all of ours, getting married while Rube and Judy are walking him down the aisle. Like, how great is that to have your elderly parents at the wedding of your soulmate?
And the little baby I was holding, he walked me down the aisle with the other son. So. But just so our viewers understand, I had separated and, you know, decided to make a change and go to Toronto to work for a colleague that I knew here. And David was separated and we just started hanging out more with each other because I didn't know anybody in Toronto. It was really natural and everybody's good. Like I get along with his ex-wife. I mean, I've known her as long as David as well because I met her back on my show and she's happily with somebody. David's happily remarried and the kids are good. And I don't know. I keep hearing my mother say everything happens for a reason. So when all this happened to me, Judy, you know, David's parents said they wanted to sell their home in Collingwood. And we both went, no, because it's right on the water. It's beautiful. Yeah. So it took me 5 minutes to pack. I'll just let you know. But I was like, we were in Ottawa. I know, we were in Ottawa at the time. But that's when going back, you know, I kind of got rerouted there a little bit, but going back to being at peace with myself, being here in Collingwood, I've been able to reclaim the Liz again. I've been able to come to peace with the things that have happened in my life. I've been able to come to peace with divorce. It just seems like I did this whole circle around to my best friend from, you know, 1989. And it's like, wow, it's amazing how life works. So I know everybody keeps saying we need to do a W Network movie on it, but it's like.
Totally. Oh my God. Yeah, I would be all over that.
I know, but I couldn't be more happier.
I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy for you guys.
Yeah. And that's how I got into meditation. Is I meditate every night. In the summer, I sit at the water and I just take that time and I journal a lot. I'm always journaling. And I've just kind of found peace. And then when I first made that move to Toronto, I had a couple horrible experiences. I was bullied out of a couple skating clubs. The coaches were jealous. They didn't want me there. And I had no intentions. I just wanted to be a resource coach because I speak so much, right? And I'm away a lot. That was when the Leo came out in me and I said, I'm done with skating. And I went into life coaching, got my degree. And I think that whole experience of learning life coaching and being on the right path in life and going after your passions and things like that allowed me the opportunity to feel that freedom that I could become that person.
Yes. And I sensed that part of what happened when you were a teen, and this is when Bob McAvoy stopped working with you, you were devastated. It ended up being a blessing in disguise. And it determined that you would move to Lake Placid to work with these new coaches, Emmerich and Margie. And you were very lonely and homesick. And this is when, as a very young teen, your mental health issues began to come to the surface. They later found out that you were suffering from alopecia. You gained over 20 pounds, maybe up to 35 pounds. But really what you were suffering from ultimately was depression and homesickness and anxiety. And your only respite was when your mom came up on weekends. And that was like that was the thing that you looked so forward to. And I just wondered if you could just tell us about that time, because you've utilized that to help other people, to help other teens, to help by giving speeches all across the country, all across the province of Ontario, and working for the Mental Health Association. You've done some wonderful stuff. Like, a lot of people would just say, okay, this is my problem. I dealt with it. I went to a doctor. I found out what it was.
We don't want to talk about it.
I don't want to talk about it. Let's just bury it and call it a day. And you literally locked yourself up in that attic as a teen. Like, I can I felt your loneliness and what you were going through, your despair. And I almost sensed that it was like you were becoming robotic. People don't realize when you do a sport like figure skating at that level,
there's so much work, there's so much training, there's so much rigorous discipline involved. My daughter's a singer, is a musical theater singer and performer living in New York. People don't realize the amount of conscientiousness and work and discipline and hours and stress and all of it that goes with it. And it's almost like you lost yourself in the process because it was just work, 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 and maybe sleep and maybe whatever. So can you tell us about that time? Because I think it's marvelous that you took that and utilized it to help others.
I grew up, you know, in a sport in the 80s. Why I say the 80s is because there wasn't a lot of resources for athletes in those days. And, you know, we didn't talk about mental health. We didn't talk about nutrition. We didn't talk about these things. You would think some of the highest athletes in the world would have all that right in front of them. Well, they do today. But in my day, it was, you never show your emotions. You never speak up. You know, I grew up in an era, take your tears out to the parking lot. We don't want to see them. Suck it up, buttercup, get back on the horse, you know, things like that. I mean, I tell the kids today at the rink, like I wasn't even allowed Kleenex or water when I trained because my coaches said it was a waste of time. Right. So yeah, it's so different, right? Especially when I went to Lake Placid, I didn't have a lot of friends in Lake because here I was, this Canadian girl coming into an American center, and I could skate better than them. So there was already that little bit of, you know, tension there. My coach barely spoke English, didn't have a lot of, you know, English vocabulary, like move my body in places he wanted it. We had no internet, TVs. We didn't have anything like that. So I literally would train 8-9 hours a day in pure silence, because there was no one to talk to. And I couldn't call home because it was way too expensive in those days to call another country. I would go up to my attic and it's literally train and sleep, train and sleep. It's interesting because the specialist that diagnosed me, he said what had happened was I was going through so much, but I had been trained not to let it out, that the only way that my body could say there's a problem was to completely break down. And that's when I lost all my hair. I gained, it actually at the end was up to almost 50 pounds of water retention. I couldn't even get a ring on my finger. Oh, my skates wouldn't fit and things like that. So it was pretty traumatic. Oh. And, you know, so between being depression and anxiety and literally a nervous breakdown, we were kind of left with, what do we do? And I remember the first thing that came out of my mom's mouth, well, that's impossible because there's no mental health in our family. I look back now and I go, wow, there was a tremendous amount. But those were the days if the stigma was at its highest. It wasn't talked about, right? You know, when you thought about stigma, mental health, your first impression was one flew over the cuckoo's nest, straight jacket in a hospital. Like that's what, you know, we thought.
Totally.
So the first part of this was how uneducated I felt about mental health. I didn't know what is mental health. Don't understand how this is happening to me, and I wouldn't accept it, right? So I was given the two treatments, drug therapy, talk therapy. Drug therapy I didn't go to because I was scared as an athlete if I did go back.
Yes. The drugs. I should just tell the listeners every such a thing about drugs. You were afraid to take an aspirin. Right?
Everything. Diet Coke was illegal. Coffee was illegal. Everything, you name it, was illegal.
Oh my goodness.
There was a little bit of a mature mind in me saying, but Liz, if you go back to skating and you're on something and you're healthy, but it's illegal and you go off it, where am I going to be then? Right? So I said no to drug therapy because of being an athlete. I wasn't at that moment. I had quit. But then in the talk therapy, there was so little out there available to normal people like me, and we had no money. I couldn't afford it, right? Yeah. So one thing that I didn't put in the book because the publishers nixed it was that night that I was diagnosed, Judy, I went home and I said goodnight to my mom. And I remember I ripped my clothes off. I sat on the floor in front of a mirror and all I could think of was how many people I had let down. I never thought about myself. I just went, I let my mom down. I let the organization down. I let my coaches down. But the one thing that really got to me was I thought I let Canada down. And that was the hardest. Those suicide thoughts were at their highest at that moment. Like, all I could think of was, if I didn't exist, everybody would be happy. If I didn't exist, they wouldn't have to worry about me. If I didn't exist, people could go on with their lives. Lord. Right? I'm so grateful that I did not attempt anything. But that's where my thinking was. And so when I went through all this, I started realizing what people go through and what their feelings are. You know, when I did these charity shows, we had such a rash of teen suicides in Ottawa, Toronto, and all these areas. And it was like, I just wanted to talk yes. to these teens, because I was sitting on that bedroom floor, buck naked, looking at myself, wanting to do exactly what they are thinking of doing. And how can I help mm-hmm. them? How can I make a difference in this world? And that's why I just completely wow. opened up wow. my story. And I remember when my dad was alive, he said, "Why do you want to tell everybody?" You know, he said, "Why?" And I said, "You know what, Dad? Mm-hmm. If it can help one other Elizabeth Manley out there, that's all that matters." So it was really important for me. And that's when I just dove wonderful. Head in. As I said, when I wrote the first book, a lot of the story was missing. And I remember saying, "Why is half my story missing?" And they said, "Oh no, Canada's not ready for that yeah. yet. Canada's not ready for Canada's sweetheart and mental health in the same sentence."
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, I tend to be a very open book. Sometimes my brother calls me and says, "You got to stop doing things like going online and just blurping it out," right? Not only does it help me, but you'd be amazed that I'll get a private message from, you know, 10 or 15 people saying, "Thank you. Thank you for saying that." Right? That's why my whole...
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. Yeah. You absolutely. Give them permission to say it to someone
absolutely.
Too. And that's a huge
and so,
gift, a blessing.
Jumping really quickly back, that was when my stars were aligned or something, but a psychologist called my mom and said, "I want to help her and I'm not going to charge. I just want to help her pro bono. I think she has everything it takes to be the best in skating." You know, I said to my mom...
That was Peter.
Yes. No, I'm sorry. Terry Orlick. Peter was my coach. At the time, that was my new coach, and Terry Orlick
was your coach. Okay,
and Dr. Yes. Terry Orlick from Ottawa University, and you know, I agreed to one session, and that turned into mm-hmm. hundreds, and that turned into years, and that turned into Calgary, and I was so amazed at everything that I went through had so much more to do than with skating. You know, it was carrying the guilt of my mom in debt to keep me in the sport. It was carrying the guilt of my parents being divorced. It was, yes. you know, I was a 16-year-old kid. I had the whole world on my shoulders. And so I was told the only way yes. my body could tell me was to break down. And that's when the hair fell out. And that's when the water retention happened. Mm-hmm.
The weight gain happened. But you also did something very important that I remember reading in the book, which is that you paused. You said,
yes,
okay,
yes.
I have to unplug.
And
for a
I do that all the time.
For more than a minute. And pause
yep.
and reflect.
You know, the big conversation today in the workforce is, you know, mental health days off. You know, you get the people that say, "Oh, they're just an easy way of taking a day off and things like that." But no, like, you need to, like, if you are just at that point of breaking, you know, just take that 24 hours and, like you say, unplug. Mm-hmm. And that's unplugging everything. That's unplugging your phone, your computers, everything. Just leave the world for 24 hours time. But one thing I do say, though, is do it for 24 hours and then get back up and go after your dreams, right? But because if you extend it more than that, yeah. then you're starting to fall into a deeper hole.
Yeah. The Gloucester Club invited you back to learn with two incredible coaches, Peter and Sonia, who helped to change your life as well. You find out in January of 84, approximately, that you get a place on the Olympic team. And I quote, you said, and it's about your mom, of course, "When I got home, Mom and I hugged each other so hard we stopped breathing. Mom, I can't believe it," I said. It makes me cry to say it. I don't know. "I'm going to represent Canada in the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
I must be dreaming." And I think around this time, there was also yep. the sports psychologist, Peter Jensen. And I say this just because we're on Finding Your Bliss, that so much of this has to do with visualization.
Yep.
And when you were the most worried and the most
yep.
sick, even before the Olympics, you
oh.
had a dream. I love that story, where you visualized in your dream the perfect routine. And you were so
yep.
excited that you wanted to call your mother in the morning and tell her all about it. Can you tell us about that? Because that's so powerful.
We're going to find out more about the dream and more about visualization when we come back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back. This is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And just before the break, I was asking you, Liz, about the dream that you had.
It was crazy. I dreamt the entire night, and it was like a week before the Olympics. And I remember running and going to see my mom, and I'm like, Mom, I had this dream. I dreamed everything. I dreamed you came running down. And of course, you know, mothers start to go, okay, you know, start to get a little, don't get your hopes up high, right? But I had this vivid dream, and it happened. That whole night happened just like I dreamt. And it was crazy. And it's funny because when I got to the Olympics, I wasn't in the greatest place. A newspaper article came out on me that I had been avoiding doing media. They came to my house, took a picture of me with our new little dog, Pixie. And the front page of the newspaper the next day was Manly dogged by inconsistency will never win a medal. And what the article was, yeah, it talked about my mental health, and it talked about, it literally said that if you suffered from any type of mental health, you're not a strong person. You can't expect someone to do the toughest feat for any athlete in the world to do at Olympic Games, suffering from any kind of mental health. They're not strong enough. They're not tough enough. Mm. And at the end of the article literally said that I was never going to be successful in life, period, because of it. Like, that was the highest stigma of mental health you could ever witness. And I just crashed. I remember at one point I was saying, I don't want to go. You know, this is what 2.5 billion people in the world think. I should be in a hospital and that and all this. But I learned this way of just, I'm going to prove people wrong. I used it as fire instead of negative. Now, I used it as negative for the first day or two, right? It just tore the heart out of me. And so when I got to Calgary, I was very, very sick because I'd emotionally been kicked in the head, and I was running like 103 fever. I had
ears blocked,
everything,
and head pounding. Yeah.
And I was spontaneously drug tested twice before the final event because they were suspicious that I might be taking something, and I knew I wasn't. So it didn't bother me that I was picked as spontaneous, but what bothered me was it takes me a long time after I compete to go to the bathroom. So it was like taking sleeping hours away from me, right? And there was a great story, and I'm not sure I can't remember. It was so long ago I wrote the book, but when I went to my final practice before the big night, there was a lot of talk about pulling me out of the games because I was so sick. And the American girl, Karen Kadavy, had been pulled out that morning because she was really sick as well. And I had begged for my practice session to see how I'd feel. I got out for my practice session, and every girl's dream happened. The entire Olympic hockey team walked into my practice. Why are they at my practice? And they were sitting in the player's box, and the coach was sitting behind them with his arms crossed, very, you know, no one was talking to each other. And I remember my coach saying, can we concentrate? And I'm like, you know what? Any other day, a whole hockey team coming to watch me practice, I'd be like, woo, you know, but I'm so sick. I just don't know why they're here. Peter Dunfield, my coach, sends me off the ice. He says, I'm going to meet you outside the locker room, and we have to make the decision if we're pulling you out of the games. So as I came around the corner, I saw the hockey team going out the back door into a bus. And the only person walking towards me, Judy, was the coach, who I didn't know from Adam. And I figured I better say something, right? So I put my hand out and I said, hello, I'm Elizabeth Manley. And he laughed and he shook my hand. He says, I know who you are. And I said, I said, thank you. Thank you so much for coming to my practice. But I have to ask you, why were you here? And he said, Elizabeth, he says, I've only got 2 seconds. The team's waiting for me. He said, but we were practicing next door on the corral, on the other rink. He said, we play Russia tonight, our biggest game of the games. And he said, we weren't practicing well. So I thought the best thing I could do was pull my players off the ice and make them come watch a champion. Judy, I was like, you can imagine, I've been beaten up by the newspaper article. I was like sick. I was everything. And I didn't even know this person. And he said this to me. And I went, pardon? And he goes, good luck tomorrow. You've got this. And thanks for inspiring my team. He walked away. And that was the pinnacle moment of my entire Olympic happenings, because as my coach came around, he saw my face and he said, what just happened? I said, all I'm going to say to you is call the meeting off. No matter what, I'm going out there competing tomorrow. And he said, what just happened? And I said, I'll tell you after. And that's the power of words. This hockey coach who I didn't even know, it's the power of the words. I was maybe 10 minutes from pulling out of the Olympic Games and not experiencing the night that this whole world saw. And it was the power of a stranger coming up. Oh,
what a message. Yeah. What a beautiful message to let people know that your kind words to someone, your supportive, compassionate, empathetic kind words can make such a difference. Make sure you say them. Good Lord.
Yeah, it can change a person's entire life. And you know, when I do that, I make sure at least once a day I compliment a stranger or I say something to a stranger that's kind, because you don't know what people are going through. Yeah. And that could just be enough to get them through maybe another day, another year, whatever. 100%. But this stranger came up and said that to me. Dave King was his name, and changed everything that happened to me in Calgary.
Oh my God, I love that. That clip when you won that Olympic winning performance, the way there was such joy and happiness and bliss to watch that. Like, I watched it several times and I cried with happiness. And the way you realized that you had done it at the end, and you just, and then they threw that cowboy hat at you and you put it on your head in Calgary. Like, it was, it was exultant. Can you just take it? I know you've been asked this 5 million times,
but asking me.
You take us back to that.
It had nothing to do with a medal. All my expressions, everything I did, it was a matter. It was all, I did it. And I just wanted to get to the people I loved. I just wanted to share this moment. And I've always said this, I have a silver medal and I'm so excited and I'm so grateful and blessed. But in my family, I won a gold medal in life that night. And that's what we call my medal, is a gold medal in life. And I say this when I do my speaking, everybody can have a gold medal in life. It doesn't have to be an Olympic medal, but if you believe in yourself enough and you go after it and you don't listen to the naysayers and you don't listen to newspaper articles, things like that, and you just go after something you love deep enough, you can have a gold medal in life. And that is so much more than any Olympic medal can give somebody. Like, I don't even have it hanging up because it's so much more than that. And, it's in my underwear drawer.
It's in your underwear drawer. Is it still in your underwear drawer? When you went on to become professional and you work with the Ice Capades and you played Cinderella in Dorothy Hamill's Cinderella, right? You were in that beautiful, beautiful piece. And I've just seen so many clips. Like, guys, go and look at videos of Elizabeth Manley skating and the joy and the beauty and the costumes and all of it. And the skating, good Lord, the skating, the beautiful, beautiful excellence of the sport.
Thank you. That's why I love pro skating, because I could just be me. I could be Liz, you know, I could do anything, right?
Yes. 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 Yes, yes, yes. There's so much more. You're living in Collingwood. We know that you're working as an executive coach. Guys, reach out to her because she's incredible. You also, I read, have a big gig coming up. You're hosting the Champions on Ice. Is this happening June 8th, 2025 at the Wasaga Stars Arena, featuring Elva Stoiko, Kurt Browning, Caitlin Osmond, Gladys Orozco Stoiko, and more. Can you tell us just briefly about that?
The city of Wasaga just loves me, and they keep asking me to create shows for them. They have a new $60 million facility that's just outstanding. And so this is a show, and you might as well more or less say David Rosen is the producer, because he's been doing so much work for me with how busy I've been. But it's going to be a great show, June 8th. It's a 2 o'clock in the afternoon show. The weather's going to be beautiful. And you know what? I am blessed to have such wonderful friends in the skating world that none of them hesitated. Kurt's supposed to be retired, and he said, Liz, I'll do it for you. So it's going to be a spectacular show, and I'm so excited
they're all coming to my area
just to help me out with this and put it on.
That sounds so great. You've worked with so many greats. You've done specials with David Foster. Like, there's so much I could talk about. I want to ask you about, because you've worked with many celebrities, but I want to ask you about your very fond relationship and close relationship with Christopher Plummer. What was it about that?
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. You're going to make me cry now. You know, when he was invited on my show, my whole family freaked out. And I'm like, who is he? Like, you know, I didn't know a lot about him, right? He took me under his wing that entire 2 or 3 days I worked with him. I got a Christmas card from him and his wife every year. And he was such a special, unique human being. Like, I just, when he passed away, I was a mess, because he is the true actor. He is the true person. He was real. He was just 110% real. And I think that was what my connection, he was not fake. He wasn't, trying to make himself something that he wasn't. He was just him. And, God, it was like a dream to work with that man, and he's so dearly missed. His career is just mind-boggling, yes, like what he can do. But that was a special connection I had with him. And, you know, when we weren't shooting, he was always standing there with his arm around me. Like I was his little, what a moment though. And what a moment for my mom, able to be there. Christopher Plummer, right? So, yes. And my mom got to have lunch with Gene Hackman. Right to the last day, she talked about that, right?
Yes.
But Gene Hackman just sat down at a picnic table with her and had lunch. So, I have some, you know, I'm happy that I talked to you today, because you have really, you know, brought up a lot of really good memories for me. It's very special. And I'm very grateful for the life I've had.
Wow, we're very grateful for it as well. There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show, so of course we're going to ask it to you as well. What is bliss for Elizabeth Manley?
Bliss is just being with my loved one. It's just being with David here and enjoying the water and having no schedule for the day. That's bliss for me. Just being able to have some quiet time and enjoying what Mother Earth can give us.
It's been a real honor to talk to you today. Thank you very, very much. It was lovely. What is the best way for people to contact you, connect with you, follow you on social media, find out how they can get you to speak or executive coach them, and all the rest?
Okay, I'm just Elizabeth Manley on Facebook. You can messenger me anytime. Twitter and Instagram, I'm Liz Manley 88. So feel free to reach out to me on those sites. I did have a website up for my life coaching, but recently it's been put down right now. I wasn't happy with it, but people get through to me in that way. So just feel free to messenger or private messenger me on Instagram.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. I just want to ask one last thing, because I wanted to ask you this and I know we're short of time, but what is your advice for skaters, or really for anyone who has a dream?
If they have a dream, they need to follow that dream, but not listen to what's going on around them, because you're always going to have people that want to bring you down. And it's not about you, it's about them. And you can't get yourself caught up in the gossip. One thing that I carried with me my whole career was, whether they're talking about me good or bad, I'm worth talking about. And that's all I need to about, right? So it's just go after what you believe in. Don't ever let anyone tell you you can't.
I love that. Well, again, thank you so much, Elizabeth Manley. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person like Elizabeth, who is living their bliss. And I'm going to say, because she's living her bliss, she's also giving permission for other people to do the same. And I think that's fantastic. You can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook.
I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Elizabeth Manley, for being on the show today. We loved having you. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, producer Eva Shabbatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Giuliani Annunziello, Ben Thomas, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.